Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Today we have part two of Rick Rubin's conversation with Giles Martin. And before we get too far, I want to let you know that Rick has a new podcast called Tetragrammaton. After about 4 to 5 years of recording Broken Record, Rick decided he wanted to talk to more than just musicians. So on his new podcast, he'll be talking to actors, directors, wrestlers, business people, anyone that Rick finds interesting. So make sure to subscribe to Tetragrammaton wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, back to Giles. In part one a few weeks ago, Giles talked about his delicate work remastering classic Beatles albums. He also explained how he collaborated with Peter Jackson's audio team and used AI while remastering Revolver. Definitely go check out that episode if you haven't already. In part two, we'll hear Giles talk about his dad, Sir George Martin, who never second-guessed his own genius. Giles also shares hilarious stories from his time as a teenager living at his father's storied studio that was destroyed by a volcano in the Caribbean. Plus, Giles talks about the time he was fired and then rehired by the legend Martin Scorsese. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin with Giles Martin from Shangri-La. We're jumping right back into the conversation about the sensitivity around working with the Beatles' original recordings.
Have you ever had an issue with, over time, sometimes the sound on the tape changes, like the top end? I've had that happen even during the making of an album. Like, if an album takes 2 years to make, from the time you cut the tracks till the time you're ready to mix it, it doesn't sound the same.
Yeah, what's this bizarre kind of, like, you know, Holy Grail type thing is that the Beatles recorded on EMI tape, and EMI tape was higher quality than other tape. And so there's tape from the 70s, especially 80s, actually, where everything, the oxides are falling off the tape and all this things happening, especially the 24-track tapes we used to have, and exactly what you're talking about. You play it once, you can see the tape heads getting darker and darker as you're playing, and you're losing that music and that information as you're playing. You're watching your work disappear in front of your eyes.
Yes.
And you realize that you made it, and then you bake the tape so it seals the oxides back on, and then you get to play it once, and then that's it. The Beatles doesn't happen. Bizarrely, it just doesn't happen. We have never had to bake a tape. I mean, we've now transferred the thing in super high resolution, and everything's backed up, et cetera, et cetera. We don't, you know, I'm not sitting there, listeners, and pressing play, you know, maybe people would like me to be doing, but I'm not doing that. I'm actually pressing a space bar when I'm mixing. It's cool.
Well, it adds to the miraculous nature it of does, all a, things Beatles.
It is very strange. And even, you know, I suppose I'm one of the closest people in the world to it in a way, which I never thought I would be or in, planned on being. But I still find it miraculous. I still find it miraculous that all of these tapes, I mean, there's two songs which don't have the original multitracks of, which there's no other band like that in the world. And this is a band that started in 1963 and finished in 69-70. Yeah. Everything is there, and everything is in the same place and is in really good condition. It's like I suppose they were lucky as they were successful, but there's something about the Beatles. Even talking to them, and even talking to my dad, I said to my dad, I was working. I do films. Well, I'm not doing, but I do also films. So I was working this Kingsman film, a sort of spy capers. And I said to him, I was trying to work on a scene. I was struggling, and it's doing with film companies. You know what they're like. I said, did you ever think you were bad at music, Dad? He went, that's a strange question to ask me. And he was very sick at the time. I said, because I'm struggling with this. I know, I always think I can't do something, and then I end up doing it. I've done it, and then I feel like I haven't done it. And this sort of like this golem-like mentality of someone going, you can't do this, and then of course you can. And this, I fight. And he goes, and he closed his eyes, and he opened them. He said, no, I always thought I was brilliant. And I had two reactions to that. It's like, one is, you total bastard, because like, I wish I felt like that.
Yeah.
And the other one was, yeah, you were, you know, they were like, and I've used this analogy before, it's like surfing, you know. I know I've done good things in my life. I know that, but most of the time, and that's surfing, I've been on a wave and it's like, this is great. But most of the time, you know, you've surfed way more than I have, but physically and spiritually. But most of the time, I'm treading water, I'm paddling, getting hit by waves, and occasionally I might catch one. They were on a wave the whole time. Like, yes. They were doing revolvers, like, we've got this idea, let's do this. Yeah. And it all worked for them. It was like, it's amazing. And they knew that. And then other people knew that, so they preserved what they were doing. There was this momentum that happened with the Beatles that has never been seen since. It's this sort of energy they had. And that's the thing that, if I talk to Paul or talk to Ringo, when I like mix an album, or, you know, sit with them, we're at Capitol with Paul, and we listen to Revolver together. What he senses, what he misses in his life is that band.
Yes.
Because it was, and you know this, because you used to have that brilliant television program with him.
Yes.
And you're the other person that spent the time with Paul talking about this stuff, yes. Which is interesting. It's going back to what we're talking about, making great records and doing the equipment about people. They don't know how they had what they had.
No.
They don't know how the four of them managed to create this surfing the wave. Yes. All of the time. And if one of them was going to fall off, they pulled them back on and carried on surfing. And that's what being a great band is, that the sum of the parts is way bigger than the individuals.
It's one of the great things I remember that Paul said in the 3-2-1 series was, he talked about the first time that Ringo filled in for their drummer who wasn't able to do a show. And the feeling, he said, he looked at John right away and it's like, I hope we could keep doing this. Like, again, they didn't know that in advance. It happened.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, this is it.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing feeling. And we have that experience in the studio when we're working on things and we don't really know what we're doing ever.
Yeah.
And then you hear something, it's like, whoa, there it is.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not because we did anything, but luckily we're able to say, there it is when it is.
Yeah. I mean, I did this Elton Rocketman film, and we had I got a band in for that. And it's a film, so you have money and you have opportunity and all that sort of stuff. And I had to record a bunch of Elton stuff. And I got this band in, and some of his early work, some of his records, and the band are great. He's got amazing musicians.
Yes.
I got this band, it was two young guys and two old guys. This guy, Robin McIntosh, is a mate of mine, he's a great guitar player, and these two young guys, drum and bass player. And the piano player I used, Dave Hartley. And there was this chemistry on that day in the studios. We just plowed through like six or seven songs, not even a click track, just like I sat there and going, well, this is easy. And you have those days, and you remember those days. We remember those days where you go, you know what, whether it's recording Joni Mitchell or you know, those things, you just go, well, this is, what am I doing here? And that's one of the things that you've always been inspirational, amazing at, Rick, is sitting back and letting it happen. And it's that I always say to people, what's it like working with artists? And I work with actors more now than I work with singers, but it's that thing where you go, you need to tell someone they can jump out of a plane without a parachute and they're going to land safely. Because that's what it is. You need to have that ability to go, okay, you're in a safe space. You know, this. And the last thing you want, and this is what your work has shown, is that I always say to people, I don't want to work with someone and then to go back and sing the song in the bath better that night. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That's the fear. It's like, this is your, and that's what's actually, that's one thing that studios do or occasions do. That's what's changed. And you can record anywhere now. If someone comes to your place here, they're going to want to perform. It's Rick Rubin, for God's sake, in this studio. So I'm going to want to perform. And that's part of the, that's bigger than any piece of equipment as well. That's so important to be able to have that. And I suppose the Beatles had Abbey Road, and that's why whenever they went anywhere else, and they did, I mean, they made great records, and Dear Prudence was done in Trident, you know, and so was I Want You, She's So Heavy, and, you know, the rooftop concert's pretty good, you know, but I love that about Abbey Road, which, you know, we've been to, and it's like, it's an interesting building, but Studio 2 is drab. I hate to say it, folks, but it's not. It's got a stairwell, a staircase, but it shouldn't be. It's like, and what happened to Pink Floyd and the Beatles? They painted the walls with color.
Yeah.
They didn't need to.
With the music.
With the music. They were like, had they been surrounded by everything, the records would have probably sounded different. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of interesting.
And they have those big, soft things on the walls. It's almost like a room in an insane asylum a little bit. It's a very big room.
Not almost, it is a room in an insane asylum. Yeah, it's a big room.
It's like a big padded, white padded room.
Yeah, but it has a magic to it. And you know, though, when you walk into that room and you talk to someone, your voice changes.
Yeah, and there is some, again, whether it's physically the space or psychologically in that we know what's happened in this room, doesn't matter. You show up to Abbey Road Studio 2, you're gonna do your very best.
Yeah, and I always think there's something about, you know, walking in the shadows of giants. It's that Glenn Miller and Ella Fitzgerald, and like their voices are still, it's that thing about sound waves never dying out.
Yeah.
And there's reflections of music from the past in that room. And in a way, you know, without being too hippie, like a posh hippie, I think that's true. I just think it's true. I think you walk into a space and you're a musician and you go, I can tell that something special has happened in this room. It's like a church.
Yeah. No, it's true. And it's true. And you can feel it when you're there. And artists are not so different from each other. The reason that artists resonate in a space is because that's a good space to resonate in.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And it's different from being at home.
It really is.
That's the thing.
It really is. Tell me about, you mentioned earlier, being your dad's ears. Talk about that. That's an interesting thing, and I know about it, but I don't really know what it entailed. The nature of music is so, language doesn't do it justice.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. How did it start, and what was it like?
Well, it was interesting, because I wanted to do music. I remember being on a skiing holiday when I was 14, and my dad was playing the piano in the hotel, because he had to do an arrangement for someone. My dad was a brilliant arranger. It was snowing, I think. I didn't want to go skiing. We were in Austria, and I wanted to hang out with him. And I was just sitting there, and I was watching him. And he turned to me and goes, so, Charles, what do you want to do? I said, I want to do music, Dad. And he goes, well, I don't think you can. And I said, why not? And he goes, I don't think you're good enough. And I was like, I was heartbroken. But I think I always had a slight punk mentality of, you know what, F you, I'm going to do it anyway. So I started busking in the underground when I was 15. You know, I was playing guitar and playing. I was playing pubs actually when I was 15 or 16. Even though I only knew four songs, me and my mates to go and play in pubs. we used to play "Is She Really Going Out With It" by Joe Jackson, but not in the middle bit because it was too, we didn't know the chords. You know, that sort of thing. It was like you know, American Pie. Oh, it's just the songs we played anyway. And then what happens? My dad, you know, when I was about a year after, he started realizing, and it was when they were lining a tape machine, they started playing like 15 IPS to 15K. He saw the meters moving, and he realized that he wasn't hearing it anymore. And he asked the engineer, he goes, what frequency is that? 10 kilohertz. And like, oh, I can't hear that anymore. And he started realizing that he was suffering from hearing loss and hearing damage. And it was quite fast. But, you know, My dad was a brilliant man, a lovely man, but he was a terrible businessman. And he signed away all his royalties from the records. So he needed to carry on working. You know, he didn't grow working to live like most people do. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want to lose his job. So he didn't tell anyone. When he see photographs of my dad, he had long hair, like a long hair went beyond his ears because he didn't want to hide it. He hid his hearing aids from people. And I started becoming his ears. And I don't know how it happened. There wasn't a progressive decision. It happened organically. He would play me stuff and I would then listen to it and hear. I remember when the first CDs came out, the Beatles and Red Blue albums, he goes, I don't think they sound right. And they didn't sound right. Mm. They sound too bright. They sound digital. And I went into Abbey Road and had a massive argument as a 17-year-old with a mastery engineer, an old mastery engineer, who also probably couldn't hear as well. That's probably the only person who could hear at that stage. So that's what happened. He would work on records and I would, and he would explain to me. We'd sit at the piano and he would play, we'd play a scale on the piano and he'd tell me where the notes would run out for him. It got to the stage where he couldn't, at the end, he couldn't hear anything above maybe middle C on a piano.
Wow. Like,
which is quite low. It's like, I can't remember. I used to think it was a kilohertz, but it's not. It's below that. To begin with, it'd be like, I'd be able to read his arrangements and know what he was trying to do. And then we'd go and record and he would never hear the top string lines. Mm-hmm. And so I knew what frequencies were really. And we've sat like doing stuff. And I said, you know, is it, you know, this is, and I can go, this is 7K. This is what, I don't solo stuff when I mix at all. It doesn't make any sense to me to do so.
That's interesting.
Because I find that like when I'm doing Beatles stuff, I won't work on John's voice and get John's voice sounding good. I'll work on John's voice in the song.
In the context, always in
because,
the context.
Yeah, because I find that, yeah, you know,
it changes.
Like, for instance, Little Help for Your Friends, I mean, where Ringo's voice was in the mix and also how Paul's bass was dramatically affected the sound of Ringo's voice. Yes. Actually, no, sorry, where's Paul's bass was in the mix? If it was central, I think it's left-hand side or something like that, I can't remember. But if I put it central, Ringo's voice would change. And it's that thing. So why would I solo? Why would I solo it? And then the bass changes the voice. Anyway, mm-hmm. All that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned about frequencies and became his ears and became. We did a project with Pete Townsend at Hit Factory in New York, and Pete, who, to his own admission, has hearing issues. Why should we be surprised? he said to me, I mean, recently, he gave me his book, and he's one of the few people that. He mentioned me in his book, like, because I was hidden. I was the person that didn't exist. And no one wanted, not everyone wanted George Martin. No one wanted George Martin's son.
Of course.
Which is, listen, I wouldn't. Yeah. And so I was seen as this precocious kind of like wannabe hanging around a studio person. I had to be very careful not to, you know, not to interfere. At the same time, I would have to be responsible to protect my dad. And there was a time where bands, he was working, I mean, because we spent a lot of time Monster out in the Caribbean. He was working on an 80s band called Ultravox, who were very nice guys. And the bass player came out of the studios as he was going into the studios. And the bass player goes, how's it going in there, George? Is it going okay? And he went, two boiled eggs. And he thought, what do you have for lunch? He thought was the question. And the bass player realized that maybe you couldn't hear as well as he thought, you know. But the thing about hearing, and I've talked to people about this, is that your hearing ability doesn't mean you can make good records or bad records.
For sure.
And even though when my dad lost his hearing, he could sense things. And
yeah, you can feel it.
I spoke to Bob Clearman about this last week, actually, we're talking about this. And he's an amazing mix engineer, and he knows that he may not have not much top end as he had before, but he knows he doesn't make bright sounding records. He's trying to work out why that is.
Yeah, I think that it's more... We hear it not just with our ears. We hear it in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. I did a forum, actually, with Andrew Sheps and for kids, actually, saying, you know, even if you're worried about your hearing, it doesn't mean, shouldn't inhibit you from doing this for a living. Yeah. Like, just because you might have perfect hearing or perfect pitch doesn't mean you're going to make great records. We know that. Do you know what I mean? Absolutely. Like, Chris Thomas going to hear out of one ear.
Yeah.
You know, and he's made great records.
Yeah, and there are great... you know, Chuck Close is a great artist and he's blind.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, great visual artist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's an interesting thing.
We have to take a quick break here and then we'll be back with more from Rick Rubin and Giles Martin. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back with more from Rick Rubin and Giles Martin.
Tell me about Montserrat.
Well, Montserrat. Montserrat was my dad's dream. Like, it's that thing. It's like, my dad always did this thing, and
Did he build the studio?
He built the studios.
Tell me about this.
Well, he wanted to build a studio. So my dad's always wanted to build places where things happen. So yes. he was at Abbey Road. He started working at Abbey Road in 1950. He left in 1966, I think. He was still doing the Beatles, and he built Air Studios, which is a place in Oxford Circus,
which I visited, and it was incredible.
It was a great studio. It was a fantastic studio.
Was it formerly a church?
No. Okay. Air Studios now is a church. That was the one in the 90s. The first one was in Oxford Circus.
Oh, so I was at the one in the 90s.
So that's another one of his legacy studios.
Yeah.
During the London time, he decided he had some money, which he thought, well, this is very uncomfortable for my dad to have any money. So he went, you know, I'm going to go and build. He was going to build the studios on a ship at one stage. He was going to buy a Norwegian ferry and build the studios on that.
That sounds incredible.
But then he realized the engine noise wouldn't give him what he wanted. So then he looked in the Caribbean. Montserrat was an island which no one went to because it was a volcanic island. It wasn't very touristy. And he went, perfect, okay. Difficult to get to. And he built the studios. And he built the studios which was one of the best studios in the world at the time. It had an Eve desk. Then later on, SSL desk when that came in. An SSLG series.
What year did he build it? Do you know?
1977 was when it started being built. It opened opened in 78, 79. Mm-hmm. And it was a studio the same as the studios he had in London. And it became a place.
It matched the footprint or same?
Same idea.
Yes.
So same
but
desk.
But it was live-in.
There were villas being rented, and we had a house that people stayed in, residential studios. The Neve desk was a custom Neve desk. I think there were only three built. One went to A&M, one went to Air, and one went to... One's still at Air at Lyndhurst has one desk. Amazing desk. And it became a destination for 80s recordings.
Yes.
So most of the Police records were made there. Mm-hmm. You know, famously, if you look at the video for... I can't remember. There's a few of their videos. You see Sting dancing on the desk, or you know, there's that. Or outside, you know, in the West Indies, it's all Ill Monster. Elton John recorded there. Michael Jackson went there. Stevie Wonder was there. Earth, Wind & Fire. Lou Reed. Duran Duran. Iron Maiden. Jimmy Buffett did Volcano. About Montserrat.
Yes.
You know, every single artist went to Montserrat. And this is the interesting. This thing I talk to Universal about now. I go, okay, you've got Abbey Road Studios. You've got these studios. You don't have to make money out of studios. You have enough money anyway. I know this is going back to the kid that wants to feed the birds and not go. Studios is where people make music, not where we make money. You can make money out of music, but let's make them creative spaces that artists want to go to.
It inspires people,
correct. Yes. And that's what my dad did. My dad probably lost about, it was eventually destroyed by a volcano. You know, don't build a studio next to an active volcano, be one of the rules. And he probably lost about $2 million on Montserrat.
Wow.
And it became the destination of record. I think there were tax breaks, I think, funny enough. I think when you were in those days, if you were recording elsewhere, it was when people sold records. And so every artist went there. And as a kid, I kind of lived on Montserrat, you know, me and my sister. It was strange. You know what it was? It was really interesting. When I was at boarding school, I was a teenager, and they would fly, me and my sister would fly out on a plane, you know, as unaccompanied minors. And you change to Antigua and then get the plane. My parents would meet me in Antigua, and then we'd go to Montserrat. And it was kind of funny, because it was also kind of lonely as well, because, you know, everyone was with their mates, but we were with Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yeah.
You know, we'd have been having dinner with these, like, you know, I, you know, remember these like bands, Little River Band, Australian band. I remember spending a lot of time having dinners with them, or Ultravox, as I mentioned, or, you know, Paul McCartney came out there. You know, we knew the Police really well because they were there. And you kind of, I was always on duty on the studio. But for me, studios was...
And were you there with your whole family?
Yeah, my mom, I had a sister. Mm-hmm. For us, it was kind of interesting because... I always remember, like, I'd be able to go into the control room in the studios when there was no one there. Mm-hmm. And there was like a Fender Stratocaster on a stand in the live room. And I knew I was allowed to touch it. And I, like, you know, one day I'll have a Fender Stratocaster. One day I might have a guitar like this. Yeah. And then I found out years later, it wasn't actually, it was a copy. It wasn't actually, it was like someone just stuck a Fender Stratocaster on like a Japanese thing. But it was an amazing experience. I think the thing for me, it's funny looking back at it, you know, because we're here in your wonderful studio. It's light and airy. Montserrat wasn't like that. The control room had a window in it, which overlooked the sea, which is beautiful. Montserrat was the top of a hill next to the volcano, which then erupted. And you could look down the mountain and see the sea and see the sunset.
Yes.
In fact, Stevie Wonder was there and said to my dad, "This is a beautiful sunset." My dad went, "Yes, it is." And then realized that Stevie Wonder was just making a joke. So he knew what time it was.
He goes, incredible.
Yeah, it's just really, like, you know.
Incredible.
But then the live room had no windows at all, you know, yeah. Like a 70s studio. And the whole vibe, a bit like casinos. The whole idea about studios is no one wanted to know what time it was.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the Stones did a couple of albums there, I think. And they would go there and, like, they'd be up till 4 a.m. But then all the interesting things that happens about, because it's residential, people that, like, the drugs and the... And, you know, me and my sister, we were staying in our house, which was where we had a house which was a guest house, an old guest house. It had 6 bedrooms going down a corridor. And that's where mainly the roadies and extras, because it wasn't that posh. And artists would stay in villas that were rented. And I said to my sister, do you want to get a backgammon? Her name is Lucy, and she's great. And she's 2 years older than me. And she goes, yeah. And so we opened up the backgammon case. And I swear, Rick, half of this quite large backgammon case had a big bag of white powder in it. Okay. I mean, like a big bag of white powder.
Yes.
And I went to my sister, I went, that's drugs. I must have been about 11 years old. And I stuck my finger in it, because that's what, in the cop shows, you remember, that's what you stick your finger in, you start like, I was obviously dabbing cocaine at the age of 11. And my parents came through and they, what are you doing? I went, I found some drugs. They were like, for us, it was like a cop show.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh my God, you know, this is, and my dad was like, grabbed it and immediately tossed this bag into the garden. You had all these hummingbirds flying around and like smoking cigarettes and saying, you know, actually, I used to be a hummingbird, now I'm an actor or whatever. But that's the, you know, this is the, it was for us, it was kind of normal. It was a weird thing. You know, we were very kind of British, as I am, a kid in an unusual circumstance.
Yes. And tell me about the place. Was there a little town close by?
There was Montserrat had 11,000 people on it at the time. Mm-hmm. It has less people on it now, because the eruption has a town called Plymouth, which was the main town, which was down the road, if you like, British Island, a colonial British town. Interesting, I went back after the volcano erupted, and I was allowed back in because we owned the studios. And I went in there with the head of police, and where there was a clock tower in the town square, a bit like Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And you could stand next to the face of the clock because the whole of the volcanic ash had piled up.
Wow.
It was an amazing thing. There's a great film actually on that this great woman director's made on Montserrat and the legacy of Montserrat. And my dad, I found it very sad. My dad's stand at the end. It was his dream. And the great thing about my dad, he made his dreams.
So beautiful.
You know, he did. He was, and you met him. He was a lovely guy.
Yes.
And he stands at the end. He's very, very old. He's like, you know, he's not the George Martin people remember. And he's there standing on the derelict side of what was his dream, the studios. And he goes, well, the thing is, you know, we all turn to dust in the end.
Yes.
You know, we all, that's the thing. We all turn. And it's like, he's fine. He's fine. I found it pointless sad, but going to Montserrat, and we still, you know, have the studios there for what it's worth. If anyone wants to buy studios in Montserrat, let me know. Yeah. No, we ever still have the studios there. It's a derelict property.
I understand.
With things falling through it. But it was a dream. It was this dream that happened. And people say to me, would you do it again? I go, well, no, time's different now. You don't need to. We can go with these microphones we have and go to a place and record something now without having to build a place, you know, mm-hmm. Because it was very tough to do for him. And so many people have so many amazing memories of their time there.
Beautiful. Do you know what sparked the idea for your dad to build a studio in that place?
He wanted to build a studio which was somewhere completely different. He wanted to build somewhere where artists could go and be away from everything else.
Yeah. And do you think that's because he had spent so much time in London making music that the idea of doing it elsewhere was it would be inspiring to him, and thus he assumed it would be inspiring to other people who've been doing it for a long time as well.
Yeah, I think there's that. And I think there's also, my dad had an element of punkin' about him as well, funny enough, that despite his stature and the fact he looked a bit like Prince Philip and the fact he spoke like he did, like, I sound like my dad and I'm the same. There's an anarchy that lies beneath us.
Yeah. Well, you can tell from the comedy albums he worked on.
So with EMI, for instance. So my dad, his voice wasn't his voice. He changed. My dad was a Cockney when he grew up. He was like, all right, come down. And he changed his voice because he couldn't get it. He wouldn't have got ahead in the music industry without being an English gentleman. And became this, almost changed his persona. He was actually more working class than at least two of the Beatles were.
Amazing.
Most people don't realize about it.
No, amazing.
So he went against EMI, you know, even on so many different levels. He didn't believe in, he didn't like the corporate world.
Yes.
He liked the artistic world.
Yes.
You know, so he rebelled against Abbey Road, built, and stood for Associated Independent Recorders. He wanted to be independent.
Yes.
There's even a Beatles Christmas message where they go, George has gone independent, you know, because he wanted to be away from that system of the factory, if you like.
Yes.
And then he wanted to build a place where artists could go and be away from the record label.
And be free.
Make, and it worked for him. I think the records that were made in Montserrat probably made $1.5 billion worth of, you know, whatever it is. I mean, like a Brothers in Arms loan was, you know, was one of
did
the biggest.
Did he produce all of the music out of Montserrat, or no, other artists worked there?
You know, and it's funny meeting people from that era. Like there's a bunch of, you know, engineers and producers that I, like Hugh Padgham and Neil Dorsman and that era of, and they couldn't believe in those days. And it sounds so hard. They would go somewhere where you'd have to get a plane to Antigua, get either a charter plane or a small boat to get to this place. And they'd walk into this room and it would be like walking into one of the best studios in the world. And my dad loved that. He loved the idea. I mean, the stories that happened in Montserrat, I mean, there were drivers, for instance, that would drive the band around. And there was always people falling out with one of the drivers fell out with another driver or fell out with a band member. Probably one of the musicians was rude to him. He stole the white pool ball from the pool table in the studios because he knew the band liked playing pool. And they couldn't get another white pool ball. No, because it was an island.
Because you can't get anything on the island.
Yeah, you can't get anything on the island.
Yeah. Like, how long would it take to get supplies of any kind if you needed something?
A couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So like just equipment and stuff like that. Yeah. And you know, just imagine the logistics of bands going out there and flying flight cases of stuff. And
yeah. I've been making albums in different places in the world.
Yeah.
And it's still a challenge.
And in those days, it was more because also...
Yes, the scale of what was needed was so much bigger than it is now.
Don't forget shifting the tapes back and forth. Absolutely. Yeah, it was worth it. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It does sound like a dream come true.
Yeah, and like most things, like the main problems that weren't actually the bands. It was like problems with bands' girlfriends and managers and people getting bored and... Yep. Getting drunk and falling into swimming pools, and I remember that as a kid. That was always there was always a drama happening with someone getting drunk and crashing a car, or it was always that kind of thing that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what artists liked about it, I mean, I spoke to Elton about it. He liked the fact that he wasn't anyone there.
Yes,
because that's why my dad chose it. Because it was an island which was really very rural, if you like.
Great. No one,
And also because it was a very black island, that's sometimes ridiculous because of the West Indies, but you have to bear in mind the West Indies has a huge sense of colonialism.
Yes.
And it wasn't touristy. So only if Stevie Wonder came here, that would be interesting. But if Elton John was running the streets or Sting was running the streets, if they knew who he was, they didn't care about who he was.
Yes.
So Elton John, there's a chicken shack. You know, everything was like, there were no proper restaurants. Elton used to love this chicken shack.
Yeah.
You know, he used to go down there and it was bizarre. I mean, I remember as a kid, there was one boat. There was one like a 35-foot sailing boat that a guy called Ken used to take people around to a beach on. And we went with Elton, and Renata was the tape op. She was the assistant engineer. And then I got back to school, and then it was like, Elton's marrying Renata. And I was like, they weren't even together.
Yeah.
And it's funny, like being as a kid, you live this kind of weird, and now you're like, things that I end up working on Elton John life story film. And see his version of the events. But it's kind of, and she was great, and I still actually still hear from her. But it's so strange as a kid. I think one thing is you realize you work around musicians or grow up around musicians. You realize that adults really aren't as bright as you think they are. And that's something I stand by today.
Yeah, I think in general that's the case.
Yeah.
It's not. We don't relegate that to musicians. People are just crazy.
Yeah, exactly. And a little crazy goes a long way. That's the other thing.
Yeah,
that's the other thing. You know, that there's an acceptance, and that's what my father had. He had an acceptance and liberalism to his approach. And
yes,
and he didn't. You know, the preconceived ideas of George Martin and the reality were two very different things.
Yes.
He just loved music. You know, it's like, his closest ally was Quincy Jones because they were two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
Interesting enough.
We have to pause for another quick break, but we'll be right back with the rest of Rick's conversation with Giles Martin. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back with the rest of Rick Rubin's conversation with Giles Martin.
Can we listen to something from the new album?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's do it.
Do you want to hear a mix or do you want to hear the sessions?
Rick? Whatever you recommend. I want to hear what you think is going to be most interesting.
Well, it depends whether it's like a new mix or a session. It's two different things. What's your favorite song of Revolver?
I like them all. I like the albums. I don't listen to songs that way. I listen to whole I listen to whole projects typically.
Yeah, well, that's hard to play one track. Listen to She Said, because I think that's quite a
great.
This is quite interesting. This, I think, it's just it's one of those songs that you forget about, but it's cool.
Yeah.
I
Do you match the fades?
Yeah, that's important.
What would it be like if you left them longer? Or you think that's also part of maintaining what it is?
That's part of what the band wanted.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's where the song ends.
Yeah, that's where the song ends.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people ask me about that. And quite often they're right as well. Do you know what I mean? That's the thing. There's a reason why the fade happens there.
Yeah.
And people go, what happens after that? And you go, well, to be honest with you, not much.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the outtakes and stuff. I mean, I never put outtakes on that we should just, like, here's the song with just no fade on it, because then it's like you have to hear the whole song to get to the bit that you want to hear.
Yeah.
I try and match all of that stuff. So I don't, in a bizarre way, I kind of like the idea of people not noticing I've done anything.
Yes.
I always have this theory. I worked on this George Harrison film, Living the Material World, with Scorsese.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin Scorsese, like a lot of people, rightfully will say, you know, what the hell is this guy doing? Why is he remixing the stuff? You know, don't. And after 4 weeks, they fired me from the project. And I was like, okay, cool. I don't mind. I mean, you know, that's what, you know. And then Olivia Harrison phoned me and said, we listened to the stuff. It sounds really bad in the cinema, or in our playbacks. And I said, well, you did fire me. And they went, okay, well, you and Marty needs to meet. And we met in Delane Lee, which is a film studios in Soho in London. And I played him All Things Must Pass. And there was, he had a button on a desk, the A and B in the room. And he went, this is the one I remember. I went, this is the one that we've mixed for the film. And he went, well, I don't understand. He goes, well, because music isn't necessarily always the way you remember it to be. And that kind of weird, I kind of like the idea of mixing it how you remember it to be.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
And that's like, I want you to listen to White Album. This is how I remember it being in my perfect world and not some Fandango modern remix of it.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? There's an arrogance that comes with that, I suppose. Because it's like, well, maybe it's how I remember it being. But there is the thing where you go, it's never quite how you remember it. And sometimes it's better and sometimes it's worse.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as it makes you feel the same thing, as long as you get the same, that's the key.
I felt a rhythm. It almost felt like it was faster. I know it's not faster.
Yeah, it's not.
But there was something, I was hearing something that gave it the feeling of forward motion that I don't remember being in the original.
Interesting.
And it felt good.
Yeah, no, but also this other thing is like, it sounds younger. And I don't mean it sounds younger.
Yes.
It sounds like the band's younger.
Yes.
You kind of, what I want to get is that these are 25-year-olds playing in a room, and they'll always be 25-year-olds playing in a room.
Yes.
Then they are younger than Harry Styles is now.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the thing about records and recording, and what I do is like, it is time travel. You're going back to that time when we're listening to a bunch of 25-year-olds in a room in the same way that we recorded them now. There'd be a bunch of 25, you know, bunch of 25-year-olds. It's timeless. That's the whole point. And so if you can go, wait a second, these guys are really like pumping and hitting their instruments, and yes, they are. That's because they're a great band, and that's what you want to hear.
Yes.
That's the exciting bit. And I was really lucky, because the first thing I did really was the Love Project. And I'm good at combining things in my head, like in that sort of process. But this will work with this.
Mm-hmm.
And the Love Show kind of starts with the drum solo from The End, which goes into Get Back. It's like Ringo's drum solo goes in the end of Get Back, and there's a string crescendo. And I knew in my head this was going to work, but then I did what people would do, where I put a grid out, and so it was like, it was 122.5 BPM, and it had like, do, 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 do. And that was the first thing, and it sounded terrible. It was like Ringo was in time, and and Ringo's a great drummer, but he should never be put.
No.
His feel is that the thing. That's the thing. In the same way that people go, you know, do you ever tune the vocals? Or it's like, no.
Yes.
No, not for any moral standpoint, just the fact it's not going to sound as good.
Yeah.
It's not going to be as good. Yeah,
It'll be less believable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's things like, you know, when I did Let It Be, and when we did the Get Back, I mixed Let It Be, and there's a thing on the piano, it's a mistake on the piano I heard for the first time. I was like, great. I mean, if it's been there.
Yeah.
You know, that's a human playing the piano.
Yeah.
You know.
Have you ever DJed? Because what you're describing in knowing what works with what, that's really what a DJ does, a good DJ does.
No, I've always thought about it. I've always thought about it.
It's fun.
Yeah, it's that. And I was in a place the other day, and there was a great DJ. I was thinking, that ability to, I just don't think my brain works fast enough.
Have you seen ABBA Voyage?
No.
Oh, worth seeing because it's truly like time traveling.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they come out on stage and it's 1979.
I've been meaning to go and see
it. It's surreal.
Yeah, I've been meaning to go and see it. I just haven't gone to see it yet. I kind of like, it's funny. It's that, you know, obviously because the Beatles, I get asked about this kind of stuff all the time. I think we can't cheat time, but we can travel time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You can visit.
And anything, anyone, like you go to Abbey Voyage and if it makes you feel elated and you're there with them, then anything that makes people feel stuff is great by me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That doesn't harm you.
No. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. Yeah. It's not, I don't think it's sacrilegious at all.
No. And also, we can be, the most people that sort of have pretentious views on this are people, aren't people that on, there are preservation, not on voyages of discovery and learning. Do you know what I mean by that? It's like, you know, my kids listen to music in a completely different way that I did. I have two teenage daughters and they'll go, hey, have you heard this band? They're really good. They're called Fleetwood Mac. And you go, yeah, I have. They go, how come you've heard of them? And you go, well, and you don't want to kind of say because they've been around. But it's like, that's great. Yeah. That's great. You know, it's like, yes. Yeah. You know, I remember my daughter saying, listen to The Chain and like going, the breakdown of the bass line, the bass section, this should be used for a television program. I was like, this was used for the beginning of Grand Prix in Britain, Formula One, but all of my life. That was the
beginning. That's so funny.
And it's that you just go, and it's the same way that if Revolver comes on, you know, I remember we were listening to Olivia Rodriguez. I mean, that's a good album. Mm-hmm. And then we were listening to Arctic Monkeys. And then Yesterday comes on in the car. Mm-hmm. And I go, Yesterday? And my daughter goes, it's a good song, Dad. Yeah. And you go, yeah, it is. Yeah. It's timeless. That's the point.
Yeah, I can remember when I was a little kid going to the record store. At that time, I was only buying 7-inch singles. There were albums, obviously, in the store, but I was buying songs. So all of the things that I were buying were things that I heard on the radio, and they were just like, they were the songs of the moment.
Yeah.
And I didn't really understand what all the other records were.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember I heard a Chuck Berry song on the radio, and then I went to the store and I got the Chuck Berry single, and I went to the front and I said, has Chuck Berry made an album yet? Yeah. And they walked me over to this section, and Chuck Berry had 50 albums. Yeah. And it was like, that was my first experience of like, oh, so this, it's not only just the single now.
But that's the thing. It's like, but that's, you know, it's great. It's great. Like even now discovering new stuff, or I love when someone puts on music.
Yeah.
Opposed to me being freed from it. You know, and you go, what's this?
Yeah.
And just being open to
the best.
Yeah, it's the best thing. It's like, and what is this? This is great.
Yeah. I also get mixed up between records that I've worked on and not worked on just because I listen to so much music.
You've worked on most of them.
Usually, yes. But sometimes I'll be somewhere and I'll hear something. It's like, wow, where did we make this? And then I'm thinking, it's like, and then I'm listening closer, and it's like, no, that's Led Zeppelin. I wasn't there. It's like, it's so weird. And then the other side, I was at this hi-fi convention. I heard this song that was incredible, and I had no idea what it was, and I Shazammed it, and it was something that I produced, and just completely blocked it out.
Yeah, I mean, or I get told about something I've done.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know. But you don't. You just move on.
No, you make stuff and you move on. And
yeah, exactly.
There's a big volume of stuff going by.
Yeah, it's just the fact just to be in work is nice. I mean, there's a thing you can't forget that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Rick.
A pleasure.
I hope it was okay with you.
It was fantastic.
Yeah,
it was fantastic. And I look forward to us doing this again whenever the stars align.
Yeah, listen. I will be happy to talk to you, recorded or not recorded. I should do the same thing for you now. It's my turn to ask you questions.
I would love to. We'll do that.
Thanks again to Giles Martin for sharing some stories and the process behind remixing The Beatles' Revolver. You can hear that new Revolver mix along with other songs he's produced at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, and Eric Zammer. Our editor is Sophie Crane. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.